Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I'm delighted now to be joined by a musician and up-and-coming young actor as well now, Steve Wall. Hi, Steve, you're welcome.
Young, I'll take that bit. Yeah.
So listen, you're here to share five songs that have shaped your life. I presume there could have been more than five.
Oh, it was torturous. You know, first of all, I thought, God, can I think of five important songs? And then I just started looking through the LPs and CDs and everything like that and writing down some things. And then it was like, oh, please, could we make it six? Could we make it seven? Could we make it 12? It's really difficult to pick just five.
Okay, well, you have five great ones. So listen, before the stunning, before the walls and all that, when you were a little kid, I think your music education started at home, didn't it? You moved around a lot as kids.
Yeah. Well, my parents met in London. They would have met in London in the early 60s in an Irish club, like a lot of Irish people of that generation. Yeah. You know, they moved over there en masse. And so four of us were popped out in London. And I would have gone to school for maybe a year or two or something in London. I have vague recollections of it around Willesden. We lived up around Willesden. And but then we moved back to Dublin and we lived in Harold's Cross with my grandparents for a while. And that was, I suppose, that was the musical birth for me.
Okay.
The house was full of music. There was records. There was my grandfather's records. Like my mother, there was six girls and one boy. And so there was all of their kind of musical tastes. Like my mother was into kind of more jazzy stuff like Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, the Bacharach stuff as well. My grandfather was big into the crooners, so he would have been a fan of Sinatra, of course, Brooke Benton, Perry Como, Val Dunican, the crooners stuff.
Yeah, you were getting it all, yeah.
And then there was stuff like Benny Goodman and all of that. There was, you know, music from the 30s and all that kind of thing. And then my other aunts, my Aunt Eleanor actually worked for K-Tel. Do you remember K-Tel?
I remember K-Tel, yeah.
They had an office in Dublin. So
they would put together
compilations, there was everything from David Essex to, Bowie stuff and all of that, those compilations. And so there was an amazing selection. So, and of course, all the Beatles records, Stones, Bacharach, Four Tops, Motown stuff, all that kind of thing. So,
okay, gee, a classic music.
All
education.
On LP one kind of lift up lid, you know, it was called a Dynatron.
You lift up the lid.
And you put the record on. So that would have been where I really first started hearing stuff. And the sing songs, there was a lot of sing songs in that house. Whenever it was like Christmas or someone's birthday, or whatever, there'd be a big gathering in that house. And the sing songs were legendary. So the uncles would be singing stuff like I've Got You Under My Skin. And my dad used to sing Old Man River. He's actually, he's down in Ennistymon now. He's listening in. He's not.
And did he
92.
He had that deep baritone, did he?
He loved the deep stuff, you know, Paul Robeson singing Old Man River. And so we'd always be waiting for the bit where you go, Old Man. And you'd hope he'd pick the starting note right. Because
You know,
get down.
It only went down
it. But hearing all of those songs, and that's where I kind of became aware of just amazing lyric writing as well. Because a lot of that stuff, you know, the Cole Porter stuff, Jerome Kearns, Oscar Hammerstein, all of that stuff, the lyrics are just incredible. They're like mini short stories and poems and all put into pretty short songs, 3 minute long, you know, pocket symphonies. They're so brilliant.
Yeah, excellent. So your first choice is Peggy Lee, The Folks Who Live on the Hill. What does this mean to you?
My mother was, she's a big fan of Peggy Lee. And for her, it was singers who, Peggy Lee had like what she called perfect pitch, as did Sinatra. And Peggy Lee was mentored by Frank Sinatra as a singer. And you can really hear the similarities in the delivery, the pace of the delivery, the perfect pitch. There's never a note wrong, you know. So she really loved singers like that, Ella Fitzgerald and Dionne Warwick, you know, who just had that perfect pitch and didn't over kind of, there was no vocal pyrotechnics or anything, didn't over egg a song, you know.
Yeah, so, under-egged it.
Because it was like, easy
it?
Over it.
Yeah. Okay, here's Steve Wall's first choice today. And this is what reminds him of his mum, Peggy Lee, The Folks Who Live on the Hill.
And we'll be pleased to be called
That's Peggy Lee, the folks who live in the hill, and that is Steve Wall's first choice today. And we were just saying there, you can hear the Sinatra phrasing there, the kind of idiosyncratic but perfect phrasing.
So that was composed by Jerome Kearns, and Oscar Hammerstein wrote the lyrics. And there's a little middle eight in the song, and the lyric is, our veranda will command a view of meadows green, the sort of view that demands to be seen. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. So listen, after the bright lights of Dublin, then you came down to earth, moved down to Ennisdiamond in Clare. Was that a shock to your system?
Yeah. It was. It was a shock. I had just started school in Templo College, actually. I did my first year in secondary school there. So, and Dublin, this would have been the mid 70s. You know, it was... still, I suppose, the Depression era Ireland, you know, but it was coming out of it. And I used to go into town all the time on my own, go into the Dandelion Market, you know, get the 15B into town and wander around. And then when I started Templo College, it was, you know, a big school, and there was even swimming on the curriculum. You know, they had a swimming pool there and loads of different sports and different languages and all that. So when we moved down to Clare, my father took over the shoe shop down there. And it was very different. We went into the Christian Brothers, myself and Joe. The girls went into the convent. And it was kind of, I suppose, like stepping back in time about 50 years.
Really?
It was, it was, it took a lot of getting used to, you know. Like the brothers were still hitting. They were still hitting. Like there was none of that corporal punishment in the schools in Dublin at that point. And so they were... You know, I saw some pretty violent behavior, you know, and it wasn't good for the confidence. You were tended to be told that you were thick and you were useless and you wouldn't amount to anything. There was a lot of that kind of language used. So it was very, very much to sort of bring you in and hollow you out and then, you know, churn them out into a job. And I remember like in... fifth year, we were all sent off. You had no choice. Like you were sent off in a minibus to do exams for the Post and Telegraphs, the ESB, the banks.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't want to, it's like, you know, everybody went off. You sat those exams. And
so literally knocked the confidence out of you.
So like, it was very much like that. Yeah. There were a few teachers that I really enjoyed, you know, lay teachers who, you know, I really loved English and all that. I wanted to do art. There wasn't really art and I remember the career guidance consisted of 10 minutes with the head brother and it was like, what do you want to do? And I said, I wanted to do art. And he just laughed. He says, there's no money. There's no jobs in art.
Yeah.
You'll go down to Limerick now and you'll do the exam for the P&T on next Wednesday with the rest of them. And so it also kind of made me as well, you know, like going down to the west of Ireland. I wouldn't change it for the world now, you know.
Okay.
Because it was a formative experience, you know. And also, you know, I could have just ended up growing up in suburban Dublin and, you know, being into rugby and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but it changed me as a person.
You would have fit. You would have fit fine, I think. You'd be a zaddy now at this stage. South County Dublin, zaddy.
Yeah.
So come here. Your second choice is the Beatles. I think it was the Beatles started you playing music, was it?
Yeah. Myself and Joe had a Beatles songbook. And it was called like The Best of Lennon McCartney or something. And we used that book to teach ourselves guitar. And I was practicing away one day, like in the sitting room down in Ennisdiamond. And my Aunt Angela, who used to work in the shop, she came in and she said, what's that you're playing? She says, is that the Beatles? And I said, it is. And she said, they were inside in the shop. And I said, what are you talking about? Don't be ridiculous. She said, they were inside in the shop.
When Lennon bought the island?
No. George Harrison and John Lennon came to Clare just after they finished filming A Hard Day's Night. So it would have been around 1965 or 66 or something.
Right.
And... they took a break with their girlfriends. Lennon was with his wife, Cynthia, and Harrison was with Patty Boyd, who he had just met on the set of Hard Day's Night. So they were secreted off to Drumolin Castle. And one day they took a drive with the chauffeur up to North Clare. They were going to go and see the Cliffs of Moher. But they stopped in Ennisdiamon in the town square, and it was lunchtime. It was lunch break from the three schools. So all these kids gathered around this big black limo. Wow. Yeah. And they wandered around the town. They were in our shop. They were in Smith's Chemist across the road. Like Barbara Smith, it's hilarious when she talks about it. She said, I was working in the shop, you know, I was in the chemist, and, you know, somebody came in, I looked up, and it was John Lennon. Now, can you imagine? 1966, yeah. I think it was, or whatever. Yeah. And it's so bizarre.
Given that you were living 50 years back in time.
And there's not a single photograph. All there is, actually, there's Super 8 footage of them at the Cliffs of Moher. George Harrison had a Super 8 camera, and he was filming.
Brilliant. But of course, nobody had a camera.
No one had cameras. So there's not a single photograph.
Look, it lives on. That's nice. Yeah. And the song you've chosen is And Your Bird Can Sing. Why this out of all of them?
It's from an album called Revolver. It was probably my favourite Beatles album. And I think there was something about when I heard that record first, the sort of the angular, edgy electric guitars in it really kind of struck me. You know, there were songs on it like She Said, Taxman. And they all, it just has this amazing sonic quality to it. And the song And Your Bird Can Sing, it just has these guitars that are constantly meandering through the song, doing these like arpeggios.
Yeah.
And it's just a really unusual song lyrically and musically. I think it's amazing.
Yeah. Revolver kind of invented new wave, really, in a way, like long before new wave.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you hear bands that new wave bands, exactly, like Television and all that. And it's like that kind of started. I mean, when you hear what is Tomorrow Never Knows, it's just incredible.
Okay, here's Steve Wall's second choice, And Your Bird Can Sing, the Beatles. And Your Bird Can Sing, the Beatles, Steve Wall's second choice today. Steve, your third choice is someone who was a massive influence on you. I think you eventually met him as well. Tell us about Rory Gallagher and what he meant to you.
I think I remember when we went down to Clare, actually, we'd only one TV station. There was RTE and there was one radio station. But myself and Joe used to attach our transistor radio to the heating system at the top of the house, and we'd try and tune into Radio Caroline and, you know, BBC or whatever we could to hear music, you know. And but RTE used to show a program, I think it was called TX, you know,
right,
short for transmission.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
And it would go on late enough, maybe on a Thursday, Friday night or something. And I remember watching that, and Rory Gallagher came on, and it was live footage from, I think it was the Ballyshannon Folk Festival or something. And it just blew me away. And I remember borrowing the album Against the Grain from one of the lads in school. His older brother used to get vinyl. And that's the one with his guitar on the cover, really close up. You know, you can see all the chips and flakes on the paint and everything. And played that album to death. And I remember hitching down to Ennis, and I'd saved up my pocket money, and I bought a check shirt and a pair of jeans. And my hair was long, and I was trying to grow sideburns just to look exactly like Rory Gallagher. And then in 1978, he played the National Stadium, and my dad brought myself and Joe up to the gig. And it was just incredible, the energy of the gig. Three-piece band. I remember he broke a string maybe halfway through the set or whatever. I remember thinking, oh my God, he's broke a string. What's going to happen? And there was no, like, you know, roadie running out with a second guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone came out and handed him a string and he just spoke to the audience. And while he was talking, he restrung it and tuned it up.
Yeah.
In about, I'd say, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And that would have taken me half a day, you know, stringing the guitar at home. And, you know, it was just incredible. And when the gig was over, he was leaving the stage, and I ran down. There was a barrier at the side. I ran down and I was waving at him, Rory, Rory. And like, he just turned and waved or something like that. And then I think
he
it was
waved around, at you.
He waved. Yeah. I was really a little fan, you know. I would have been probably, I don't know, 15 or something.
So when did you meet him?
We did, The Stunning did The Lark by the Lee in Cork. I think it was 92.
Oh yeah, and I remember them well. Yeah, we opened, on the back of the lorry. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and we opened for Rory. He was headlining, and before the gig, one of the crew came back. One of his crew came back, and I had a brand new Vox AC30 amp. A company called Rose Morris in the UK had taken over the license for making Vox AC30s. That's the amp that the Beatles played and everybody, and Rory played one as well. And the guy came back and he said, look, Rory's amp is cutting in and out. It was a hired one for the gig. And he said, who owns the new AC30 on stage? I said, oh, that's mine. He said, can Rory use it? And I said, I got down on my knees and I said, please let him use it.
Yeah, Rory the relic. Yeah.
So after the gig, when Rory was getting off the stage, you know, covered in sweat and everything, I was waiting at the bottom of the steps at the back of this, you know, back of this truck. And I said, hey, Rory, I'm Steve. You know, you played through my amp. What did you think of it? And he said, oh, it's really nice. He said, is that one of the new Rose Morris models? And like I said, yeah, what'd you? He says, it's really nice, you know. And he was covered in sweat. There was loads of people pulling and dragging off him and everything like that. And all I was there was, when I think of it, it was so embarrassing.
Ah no, that's magic. That's magic.
But he was really nice. He was he was patient and he was civil. It was lovely. Okay. Again, not a photograph.
Yeah, no, obviously. Yeah. Okay. Steve Wall's third choice. This is Rory Gallagher. This is Cradle Rock. The great Rory Gallagher there, Cradle Rock, and Rory, an influence on so many generations of musicians, but also on Steve Wall. So Steve, you went to Galway then, ultimately. I presume this was like discovering a whole new world, that you were in your element there, people doing music, people doing arts, all that kind of thing.
It took a while. It wasn't like immediate. When I went up the first year there, it was, wasn't great because I took the first course that I was offered when I did my leaving.
Go on, give us a laugh.
It was mechanical engineering. God knows why. I thought, like, I used to be good at fixing things, you know, bicycles and all this. And I thought, oh, I'll learn about engines and, you know, spanners and vice grips and vices, all that kind of thing. So, no, it couldn't have been further from the truth. It was basically like looking at Chinese. I didn't even do physics in school. And it was all about physics and mathematics, which I almost failed. So the first year was pretty miserable. I was in the regional tech, and I just used to spend all the time in the library. I was big into reading, you know. I fancied myself as an existentialist. So I was like smoking Galois, reading Camus and Sartre and De Beauvoir. And,
yeah, I'd say you weren't alone down in Galway, were you, as an existentialist?
Well, there weren't too many of them. They were mostly budding engineers from Mayo.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, so there wasn't a lot of that. And then what happened was I went to see, there was a lunchtime concert one day, and there was this band played in the college called New Testament. And the main man of the band was a guy called Eamon Dowd. And I ended up joining that band. And Eamon Dowd was doing, he was an art student in the college. So through him, I met the art students and all of that. And that's when it started to change.
Found your tribe.
Yeah. It was like I found my tribe, you know.
And come here, we've heard people like Tommy Tiernan and stuff talk about this, and a lot of people from that kind of era, not just in Galway, probably Dublin as well, probably Cork to a certain extent. Was it more, it was more tenable, like as in affordable, like to kind of get into following your passion and kind of taking time over it and stuff in those days?
It was. And even though, like, I mean, like that time in Galway was incredibly creative, because you had the Druid Theatre starting off, you had the Galway Arts Festival, Machnas, the Film Fla. It was becoming like the arts capital of the West. But all of this was done with very little funding. It was done by people who were mostly, a lot of people, on the dole, on social welfare and on all kinds of, you know, ANCO courses and everything.
Yeah.
You were trying to do what you felt you were, what you really wanted to do, by basically staying on the dole or whatever, you know. Like, we were on the dole and the stunning for the first few years, you know. Like, and it got us through it. And that's why I think the basic income scheme for artists would be a really important thing, because like, to have, you know, artists, they need support, especially in the early time. And the social welfare system in Ireland.
Bands need time.
Yeah, yeah. The social welfare system in Ireland actually supported us through those early years.
Yeah.
You know, like, I remember signing on one day in Galway, and the girl behind the hatch said, you were mighty on the Late Late Show last night. When do you think you'll be signing off? You know?
Yeah.
And like, we weren't, you know, we weren't screwing the system or anything like that. We were getting paid. We were going around the country doing gigs for £150, and it was all we never got paid ourselves. Everything went into a pot to pay for the records. You know, we didn't have a record deal. So we funded Paradise and the Picture House ourselves, you know, and
but
all
then
those singles.
You had huge success. Paradise and the Picture House, your first album. It went to number one in Ireland, stayed there for 5 weeks, back when people bought records as well.
Yeah.
So does it become more tenable then, like?
Oh, yes, of course. We weren't still signing on, you know what I mean?
I know I don't want to sound like the Christian Brother back in Ennis Diamond, no, but are you making a good living at any point? Like,
you can't. There's very few musicians now I know that are full time and making a living just from music, because the only income is from touring, and the touring circuit has shrunk due to all kinds of reasons. You know, it's much smaller than it was back in late 80s, early 90s. You know, we used to be out doing six nights a week. You know, now for all kinds of, you know, reasons, people have other reasons.
And there's big beasts sucking up a lot of
the, and
that
also
kind
there
of
was there wasn't the same
well,
amount of you know, there was a lot of Irish acts on the radio, because there was only one radio station. There was 2 FM, so they sort of made household names of a lot of acts because they were playing loads of Irish music. There wasn't the competition. They weren't all you know, trying to play the latest Beyonce or Kings of Leon or whoever, you know what I mean. So loads of Irish acts were on the radio and on the television. And then that filtered through to greater 10 bums on seats around the country. Today it's very different, you know. It's harder to get on the radio. Gigs, you're competing against gigs every week in the Three Arena, or big, you know, massive gigs. It could be Oasis or God knows who, you know.
Yeah.
So it is harder for Irish acts.
But
it's
still
harder.
I imagine that the days of that early success and everything, they must have been heady times all the same. Did
it was
you enjoy
fantastic.
It, yeah?
It was fantastic, you know. I mean, 1990 was Ireland's summer of love, you know. Yeah. You know, we had Italia 90. It was the first Fela.
Trip to Tip.
And we were number one in the charts. It was just a really special time, you know. It was fantastic. It was optimistic. It was fun. And young Irish students, young Irish people, it was like a new era.
There does seem to be a renaissance now, doesn't there, in the Irish music scene, in terms of, like, a lot of young people now, their favourite bands are Irish bands again, the way it would have been when we were kids.
Yeah, I think it's really healthy. And I think it'd be great to just see that reflected as well on radio, and that there would be great to see that support, because you see a lot of Irish bands, Irish artists, you know, they get to their first album or something like that, and it's very hard to sustain it for years. You know, you get the few lucky ones manage to break through. It's all about basically exporting yourself. So I think there should be assistance in terms of successfully exporting yourself, because Ireland, it's too small really to make a long term living out of. So if you can successfully export yourself, you know, get into Europe,
take it to
UK,
that next
whatever,
step.
That's important.
And someone who did successfully export himself is your next choice, Van Morrison and Wild Honey. Why this?
I think that's sort of, like, I discovered a lot of Van Morrison stuff during that time in Galway. Galway was full of, at that time, Donegal people, because there was no college in Letterkenny or anything. And the Donegal people were way ahead of everyone. They had multi-channel TV
that they were
getting from the north of Ireland.
Cosmopolitan.
Whereas, you know, down the south, Clare, Mayo and all that, we were in the dark ages, you know. So musically, they were way ahead, the Donegal people. They had great records. They knew about stuff. So I remember whenever you were at a party in the house and it was Donegal people, you were hearing great music, you know.
Okay.
And there's also fantastic musicians from Donegal. So where I heard, I suppose, Van Morrison stuff, apart from Brown Eyed Girl on the radio, was in Galway, and I discovered the more that other side of Van Morrison, the Celtic soul and everything. And this song here now, Wild Honey, is from an album called Common One, And it's just a really beautiful album with the most amazing brass arrangements on it by Pee Wee Ellis.
So here we go. This is Steve Wall's fourth choice. This is Van Morrison, Wild Honey.
Open your arm in the early morning where the light comes shining through.
That was Van Morrison, Wild Honey, and that's Steve Wall's fourth choice today. Steve, before we finish up, you have a whole new successful career as an actor now. Just give me one snapshot of it, right? One of the wilder experiences. So you got a call at short notice to be in Dune 2, correct?
Yeah, I did.
Tell us about that experience.
I had auditioned for a couple of roles in it and then forgot about it because like, over a month had passed or something. And then one morning I got a call, could I go to Budapest that night? And so I did, I downed tools. And the next morning I was, brought onto the set to meet Denis Villeneuve, who was a real gentleman, a lovely man. And I hadn't even seen the first Dune at that stage. I was just really hoping he wouldn't ask me, you know, in the first film. And then he said, delighted. Thanks for coming out short notice. You have saved my life, he said. And I said, I bet you say that to all the boys. And he says, come over and meet the cast. I had no idea who the cast was, you know, who they were going to be. And then there was this kind of little circle of people chatting in costume. And he says, hello, everybody. This is Steve. He is playing Bashar. Steve. And they all turned around. And I was like, oh, my God. It was like Christopher Walken, Charlotte Rampling, Austin Butler, and I'd only just seen the Elvis movie the week before.
Wow.
Stellan Skarsgård, Florence Pugh, and all, they all turned around and went, hi, Steve. I mean, I had a tiny role, you know.
Yeah,
I had one line in it that I kept freaking out that I was going to forget, you know, because I was just so entranced, like doing the takes, watching Christopher Walken with his strange enunciation, and it was different every time he said it, you know, this whole thing, you know. And then I was like, oh shit, here's my cue, what's my fucking line again, you know.
But come here, in general the acting is going well. I can admit now that, like, I would have been talking to you around when you were just starting to dip your toe into the acting, and I did think at the time, like, this is fairly ambitious. Like, he's great at this hour of his life. And I know you've done a bit, you've been involved in theatre a bit when you were young, but it's turning out really well for you, isn't it?
It's, you know, it's been going, it always looks busier than it is, you know, because you film something and then it doesn't come out for a year or two afterwards, you know. So sometimes a couple of things can come out. It looks like you're really busy, but you may not have worked in the last year, you know. But, you know, this year got off to a good start. I did season 3 of Hidden Assets, which was a really great experience, and the scripts were fantastic of the new season. I did a great Irish indie movie called Kung Fu Deadly, which is really funny, set in Dublin's Chinatown. And and I did a thing for German television there that was, they're shooting 26 episodes. It's kind of a fantasy series about mermaids saving the oceans. And I played like a 400-year-old creature.
Excellent.
So it was a bit of fun.
I'm not objectifying you, but there'll always be work for those cheekbones and those eyes, I feel, and only getting better as you get on. Your last choice is an Irish band, Interference, who are kind of now really kind of legendary. The song is Prayer Before a Voyage. What does this song mean to you?
I think this song, in a way, encapsulates a lot of, I suppose, you know, as you get older, you lose people, you know, more people are gone, you know, more people pass away, and, you know, you encounter more tragedy. And this is a song, I suppose, in a way that, you know, I've sung it at a couple of, you know, funerals for close friends and family. And also there's a sort of a, I don't know, it's by Fergus O'Farrell and Malcolm McCarthy, who wrote the lyrics. He's a Buddhist poet down in West Cork, and it's just a work of art, the song, and it has such a calming influence. It's really beautiful, and especially even at the moment, I've been really, like a lot of people, really affected by what's going on in Gaza, and it's so upsetting and barbaric, and just inhumane what's happening. And I think when you hear songs like this, that, you know, that an artist can write a song like this and it has a sort of a healing effect. I mean, nothing can heal what at the moment what's going on over there. But that would be my aim in the next months, is to try and write a similar song that can kind of, I don't know, sort of just address this evil that is going on, you know, in the world, but particularly in Palestine at the moment, to address it without being kind of preachy or anything, you know. And that's the difficult thing, I think, in art, is to sort of, is to react to something, but in a way that draws people in, yeah, as opposed to telling them off.
Yeah, and music, I think, can do all of that in ways that maybe sometimes a book or a film or anything else. Music is a certain thing that can, yeah, make you feel, yeah, things, can soar.
And heal, you can see by the amount of people that are, yeah, going out marching to try and sort of get our government, you know, to pass the Occupied Territories Bill. It's so important. It's not about, you know, as a previous guest a couple of weeks ago mentioned on your show, competitive empathy. It's, yeah, really about people who are genuinely upset at what we're seeing every, okay, day on our screens.
Okay. So, Steve, the stunning play, The Salt Festival, on Saturday, July 19th. You're playing the Galway Arts Festival on Saturday 26th, which is sold out, I think.
Yep.
But for more tour dates and information, people can go to thestunning.net. But we'll finish now on your final choice. This is Interference, Prayer Before a Voyage. Steve Wall, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brendan.
For what do I wish? Not for stone or for wood, nor of water.